Okay, so thank you everybody for coming. This is sort of a part two. I know I said each year is independent, and so it is. We've been discussing the topic of chomesh, of giving a fifth of one's assets to tzedakah. Now, the Shulchan Aruch seems to say that it's the mitzvah min hamuvchar. That's the language of the Rambam, we'll see maybe next week. That sounds like that's the ideal of what a person's supposed to give. If you're an average person, you give 10%. If you're poor, you give whatever you can. If you're wealthy, the ideal is to give a fifth. What we saw last week, though, is the Gemara in Ksubas and the Gemara in Erchin, which said that there was a takonas usha of hamivazves al yivazves yoser mechomesh. That if you're going to fritter your money away, don't give away more than a fifth, because then you might become poor and rely on others. So that language, the connotation of bizbuz, of wasting away, sounds like that we really don't recommend you giving away more than a tenth. But if you're going to, we're imposing a ceiling. It's not a goal, it's a ceiling. So the question is then, where does the Rambam and where does the Shulchan Aruch kind of get that language of the mitzvah min hamuvchar, or the at least the target? So that comes from the Yerushalmi. So let's turn in the big thick booklet to, it's the Yerushalmi Peya. So it is, it's the page that says Peya and Dalet Amid Beis. Mm-hmm. So this Gemara is on the Mishnah that we say every day in Davening. Elu Dvarim She'en Lehem Shiur. These are the things that have no limit. Now, limit both means a minimum and a maximum. If you do a little bit, you fulfill the mitzvah, and if you give a lot, you do an even bigger mitzvah. So one of the things listed in the Mishnah is gemilus chesed. So any chesed that I do, I'm mekayem a mitzvah. If I do even more, then I get an even bigger mitzvah. So turn the page one more. Sorry,
what?
Kenny.
One more?
No, you got him on the wrong page. You're...
Oh, I got him on the right
page. Okay, so if you look, we're by the two dots of Gemilas Chasadim. It's five lines in. So, Hadad de Tamar Begufo. So, the Mishnah, the Gemara Yerushalmi says that when we said that Gemilas Chesed has no shear, that's talking about with your body. Doing Chesed, like Hachnasas Orchim, Bikur Cholim, that stuff. With your body, that has no minimum, no maximum. Avol b'mamono yeshlo shir. But when it comes to your money, there is a shir. Va'aisi ki demar Shimon ben Lakish b'shem Rabbi Yehuda ben Chananya. And this goes according to Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish in the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Chananya. That's not who we said last time. Chanina, I'm sorry. This is not who we said last time. In the Bavli, it's a different person's name. I think it's Yehuda Bar Ilo, maybe. Different person's name. What's the language here? Nimnu be'usha. What does nimnu mean?
Names are appointed. They discussed it and they decided.
Right. So nimnu literally means like they counted, they took a vote almost. So they were discussing it, and then they decided. So the connotation of they were discussing it means that this debate had been going on beforehand. We said this last week, even according to the Bavli, that who were the ones that were arguing? We brought a story of somebody that wanted to give more tzedakah, and then Rabbi Akiva stopped him. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Akiva lived before Usha. We'll see in the handout that I gave out about the timeline. He was one of the Asara Haruge Malchus, which happened before Usha. So this was a discussion that was going on for decades. And in Usha, they seem to have decided, Sheyehe Adam Mafrish Chomesh Minachasav Lemitzvos, that a person can separate a fifth of their assets for mitzvos. So this is a very different language. There's no language of bizbuz. If you want to separate, you should separate up to a fifth. So it doesn't sound, you know, it may not be like an ideal, but it doesn't sound like you're wasting. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you should try to give as much as you can up to a fifth. But there's also another difference. What does it say over here?
Le mitzvos.
Right. That sounds like not only tzedakah or hektish, what we were talking about in Ksubas and Erchin, this sounds like it's talking about all mitzvahs. So this version of the Usha story is much, much broader. Meaning last time, when we talked about the Bavli's history, we quoted some professors, Professor Orbach, Rabbi Benny Lau, he talks about it, he quotes from others, how this was seen as almost a trying to ward off Christian influence. That Christians were very big into charity, and you give away whatever you can and trust in God, which meant trust in the local government to give you money. And so there were a lot of, and Professor Orbach quotes that the reason why Christianity had such a hold on the empire and why the Roman Empire was so threatened by them was because everybody loved them. They're just giving out stuff. They're giving out handouts, and they're giving away all their things. So everybody loves them. So Chazal wanted to, again, it wasn't to attack the Christians, but it was to prevent that Jewish-Christian ideology from seeping in to the, rabbinic Jewish community, of saying that you shouldn't give away more than a fifth, because then you'll become dependent on the state or the government, and we don't want that. Over here, though, according to the Yerushalmi, it's much broader than that. It wasn't just chesed. It was literally, I love my religion, and so I want to give away as much of it as I can in order to do the best possible. If you have to make a takana, it sounds like it's an issue. But the fact that they only made this takana now meant that it wasn't as serious beforehand. So why would that be? Why only now would they have made a takana about all mitzvahs? Yeah, Eugene.
I mean, in all the weeks I have not yet heard the concept of Chas V'Moinoi.
Yeah. So that is a concept in the Gemara, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares about the money of the Jewish people. Just like Yaakov Avinu went back for Pachim Kitanim, he went back for small little vessels, because a tzaddik cares about everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you. You don't want to fritter it away. Hashem gives it to you for a purpose, and so you have to do with it exactly what you can to maximize your avodas Hashem, so Hashem should say that too. That's certainly part of it. I think another part is that when did Takanas Usha take place? I mentioned last time, and you can now see this in the supplementary handout that I gave with the timeline, this happened right after the Hadrianic Decrees. So we'll now go look at the timeline. So 70 CE, maybe a little bit earlier, the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. 76, Emperor Hadrian is born. Around 80, we don't have exact years, Rabbi Gamliel is appointed the Nasi in Yavne. So according to the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked, let's move the Sanhedrin to Yavne, ten li Yavne v'chachameha. And so around the year 80, Rabbi Gamliel II is appointed as the Nasi. And keep in mind, Rabbi Gamliel, the Yerushalmi, we'll talk about him a little bit later. Around 90, Rabbi Akiva begins to learn Torah. And so he's becoming a Talmud Chacham. How long did he learn for?
He was 40 years old.
Right, he started when he was 40.
Until he was 120.
Yeah, so for the next
80 years. Times, right?
Well, yeah, so around for the next 80 years. From 96 to 98, Nerva is the emperor. Also keep that in mind for later in the Yerushalmi. Followed by Emperor Trajan, and then during Trajan's reign, from 115 to 117, for those that were here for the scholar in residence for Dr. Mermelstein, he mentioned the second Jewish revolt. This was known as the Diaspora Revolt. The revolt didn't occur in Eretz Yisrael, but in Jewish communities, both to the north of Eretz Yisrael, in like Turkey and Greece, and then especially in Egypt. So Trajan was the one that crushed those revolts. One of those generals was Hadrian, who then becomes emperor in 117. About a year later, Rabbi Gamliel dies. Who's Rabbi Gamliel's son? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. We don't really know much about Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's early history, presumably because a lot of it was spent in hiding. Because the Nasi was perceived as an instigator. So they, during the time of Nerva, Rabban Gamliel achieved a certain degree of recognition from the Roman government, but then, after the Diaspora War, followed by the Bar Kokhba revolt, which we'll talk about, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel basically had to go into hiding for a while. So the Bar Kokhba revolt took place from starting around 132. The causes for the revolt are a few. The first is that Hadrian, if you see his picture on the coin, so it's a little bit hard to read. If you look on the obverse side of the coin to the right, you see a word. It's hard to read, but if you look on the map next to Beitar below, you'll see another word. You'll see Aelia Capitolina. That's Yerushalayim. After it was destroyed, Hadrian rebuilt it as a secular city. He built a temple to Jupiter on Har Habayis. They plowed over Har Habayis. People really did not like that. The Jews did not like that. Some historians dispute this, but according to the Gemara, he banned Bris Mila. Hadrian was a Greek citizen first, and he was a Hellenist. And so castration was considered an abomination in the Roman Empire, and Bris Mila was seen as a form of mutilation akin to castration. And so when the Romans were okay with the Jews, they made an exception. Castration was illegal. They said circumcision is okay. Hadrian said, no, we're getting rid of all of this. So that also annoyed the Jews. Another is tensions with the wealthy Romans that were shipped in after the destruction. They owned a lot of land. And then moreover was Messianism, right? So how many years were there between for the first Golos? 70 years. So if you add 70 to 70 CE when the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, you get around the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt. So there was this sense of Messianism that 70 years later, we're going to get it back. And so Bar Kokhba and the spiritual leader of Rabbi Akiva launched this revolt. Rabbi Akiva was killed, we believe, around 135. If you look at the map, the blue area is the area that Bar Kokhba controlled at the peak of his reign. As you can see, Yavne is not included in that. Interestingly enough, Yavne firmly remained under Roman control. Ultimately, Bar Kokhba's revolt was crushed. The impact of that was several things. First is we get the name of Palestinians. Hadrian got rid of any trace of the name of Israel or Judea. He named it Syria Palestina. That was the Roman principle.
That's from Hebrew. He studied the Tanakh and said, who were the greatest adversaries to the Jews? The Plishtim. So he had to name those someone to the Plishtim.
Exactly, yeah.
No,
you're 100% right. That's where the name comes from.
The Plishtims were not, the Palestinians are not Plishtim.
No, but that's where he got the name from. They're not related. Another impact, which is very important for us, is the depopulation. If you look at this quote from Cassius Dio, there should be 850 of their most important outposts, 50 of their most important outposts, and 985 of their villages were razed to the ground. 580,000 men were slain, and then famine, disease, fire. Thus, nearly the whole of Judea was made desolate. Whenever we find buildings and archaeology in Yehuda, it's all destroyed and burnt. Because the Romans literally wiped out, they depopulated, they sold them as slaves, they ran away, or they just killed them, or they forced them out. There were almost no Jews left in the entire Yehuda area, including Yavne, which basically meant that the Jews had to go north to the Galil where Usha is. Another impact is the Hadrianic decrees, which forbade all outward displays of mitzvos. All outward displays of mitzvos, including smicha and kiddush hachodesh, but all mitzvos were forbidden at that point.
This was after they crushed.
Yeah, so Bar Kokhba was seen as this religious messianic figure. So Hadrian just says, forget this. No more Judaism in Israel, basically. So Usha happens after the Hadrianic decrees were repealed. After 138, Hadrian dies. Antoninus Pius becomes emperor, not the Antoninus with Rebbe, that's later. And he repeals a lot of the decrees. So you have an economically depressed Jewish community that is now just able to start performing mitzvos. So what would you think then? They would want to spend as much money, or they would be willing to be moser nefesh. I was just moser nefesh to fulfill mitzvah secretly, or I couldn't. So now forget about just giving tzedakah to poor people. I want to do whatever I can to do mitzvos in general. So this may be a reason why, yes, before Usha, this discussion was more limited to tzedakah. But once Usha was established, and now we were trying to build up Jewish society in an economically depressed time when people are just beginning to be able to do mitzvahs openly. So now we have to say, up to a fifth, we want to encourage people to do mitzvahs. So we're saying you should strive to give as much as you can, or it might be a value and not be called wasting money like it is in the Bavli. But we have to impose very hard lines, whereas beforehand you either couldn't do mitzvahs, or maybe it wasn't so special, or you were more economically well off. So that might be another reason as to explain this change of language.
So it's a healthy sign to put a maximum.
It's a healthy sign, or at least it's a sign of change, that yes, you're still poor, but now people are excited to do mitzvahs, and they want to, and we also want to encourage that, like you said. So we're not calling it wasting. But at the same time, we have to put checks and balances. Yeah, exactly.
You know what the Romans did in Judea? Not any really different than what the Romans did anywhere.
Really? Okay. I'm not so familiar with other practices.
The Carthage.
Right, that's true. I would say that, I mean, Carthage is pre-imperial, so I don't know if I would compare. But you're right. They really did uproot Carthage.
Yeah, they were brutes.
Yeah.
And you know, that's, and I'm also wondering why you would think the Jews would be so anxious.
So what?
So anxious to do mitzvahs.
Anxious.
I'm not sure.
I think they're anxious to rebuild.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's part of their... Meaning, I also want... I didn't say this. I forgot. Hebrew was almost entirely forgotten at that point. Based on a lot of people prove from, like, various things in Gemara that people had trouble defining certain objects using Hebrew because Hadrian basically stamped it out. So, like, people want to reclaim that. They want to rebuild. That's what I would say. Well, let's continue.
You know, but throughout that period of time, Hebrew was not the language. It was Aramaic.
You're right that it wasn't like what was spoken, but like people still knew it. Like we don't speak Hebrew on a day-to-day basis.
And we don't know it, I'll tell you that.
Okay, you know, you're right. But like, you know, if you open up a Siddur, you open up a Chumash, like we can recognize at least some words.
Yeah.
Actually, I spoke about that for the young professionals, about how we know more Hebrew than Philo did. Philo was this great Alexandrian scholar that knew all of Tanakh and all of science and everything. He didn't read Hebrew. Anyway, so let's continue. So the Gemara asks, Ad Heichan. So how much, continuing in the Yerushalmi, where we left off. So Ad Heichan. How much? So we talked about a maximum. The Gemara asks, what's the minimum? So Rabbi Gamliel, Ben Anino, v'Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, so we, two people, Chad Omar Kidei Truma, U'Trumas Meiser. One said the combined Truma and Trumas Meiser, which is approximately 3%. Right, so Truma is... approximately 2%. Right, so it's approximately 2%, and 10% of 2% is 2/10 of a percent. So 2.2%, which they kind of round up to three, because if you take the more generous shear, you get closer to three. That's what the Mefarshim say. V'charna Amar, Charna says, Kabed es Hashem mehoncha umeireshis kol tivuascha. So this pasuk is from Mishle. Honor Hashem with your wealth and from the beginning of your tvua, which is similar to Bikurim. So you could say that that's Bikurim. But then the Gemara says, Kimei Reishis Kol Tvuascha, by giving to charity an amount equivalent to the first of all your produce, which the Mefarshim say means Truma. Now you could say it's Bikurim, but what also does the Mishnah say? Elu dvarim she'ein lehem shir, ha-peya ve-ha-bikurim. So bikurim, there is no shir. So the Gemara says, okay, so if you have to pick what's the next thing after bikurim that has a shir, it's truma. So that's what we go to. But now, there's one other thing. So what's the shir of truma, right? We just said that it's 2%, but I also said it could be a little bit more, a little bit less, because it's rabbinic.
Yeah. The amount.
So both the floor and the ceiling of tzedakah are rabbinic. I just want to put that on the table. There's a mitzvah to give tzedakah, and the rabbi said, oh, we're putting in limits here. Mm-hmm. How could the rabbis put in limits to tzedakah? That's another question. How can I tell you that theoretically the Torah wants me to give and give and give, and the rabbis just say, stop? I don't think rabbis ever tell you to stop giving money. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying that you are allowed akiras davar min haTorah by a shev al tase, right? So that is an answer that people give. That is an answer that people give, that the rabbis are allowed to tell you to stop doing a mitzvah. They can't tell you to do an avera, but they could tell you under certain circumstances to stop doing a mitzvah. Exactly. Right. So you have to say that. Meaning you have to say that this is a special, that the Nimnu of Usha is basically saying we're telling you to stop fulfilling a mitzvah. That's a chiddush.
Well, that's not telling you to stop doing it. They're saying don't do it to what we consider excess. That's what they're saying.
Stop as in.
But you're saying it's excess.
Yeah.
But if the shir is rabbinic, then midoraisa it's not excess.
Yeah, but now you're talking like the monks.
Well, but exactly, and that's what Rav Asher Weiss says. That doesn't make any sense to say. The Chassam Sofer is of the opinion that before Takanas Usha, I would have to give away my entire bank account. Obviously, my life comes first, so I need to have whatever I need to survive. But I have to give away everything else if people need it. And Rav Asher Weiss says, no, that doesn't make any sense. You can't say that. We'll get to Rav Asher Weiss a different week. But Rav Asher Weiss basically says, no, that can't be. But I'm just saying, we have to appreciate where the Chassam Sofer is not, the Chassam Sofer wasn't stupid. That's where he's coming from. That based on our logic, the rabbis said this is excess, but the Torah doesn't seem to have said that. That's all I'm saying.
Why is the analogy made with Truma and Masrot? Is it talking about your annual income that should be?
So we'll get to annual versus net worth in a minute. And this is, the Bavli never mentions that distinction. We in the Shulchan Aruch said that the fifth and the 10% are always calculated based off of profit. The annual profit of the year. Where do they get that from? Bavli doesn't say it. They get it from this Yerushalmi.
The first half year seems to say net worth.
I'm sorry?
The first half seems to say net worth. The maximum
right.
said from all of your money.
Yeah, so the Gemara is actually going to ask that right now. So Rabban Gamliel benina ba'a. So Rabban Gamliel asks, Kumei Rav Mana? He asked Rav Mana, Ma chomesh b'chol shana v'shana? L'chomesh shanim hu mafsid kula. So if you give away
that's a fifth of their maximum, but a fifth of a fifth
Right, so you could say that I'll just keep dividing into five. Gemara doesn't say that, though.
No, I don't know. Did they know the math?
Okay, that's not even math. That's just like
four fifths.
I could just right. So, but Rav Mana says Amarle b'tchila lekeren. The first time you ever do it in your life, you're supposed to give from your net worth. Mikan ve'elech l'sachar, and after that, it's always the profit.
Okay.
So yeah, you
new money.
Exactly. So Yaniv, you're right. You could have said the other thing.
Yeah.
apparently that was untenable for the Gemara to suggest.
Because it's your double counting on the dollars.
Right.
Chronologically, when is Karen?
Right. So
Karen is zero.
Right. So that's true. So what I think most poskim say is that the first time you ever decide to do this in your life is where you do
a lifetime maximum.
So you should teach your kids to give tzedakah very early.
Exactly. Teach them to give very.
At the end of the day, it's the same thing. We're saying the same thing.
No. If it's from the Karen.
Meaning the first year it's net
first
worth.
First year it's net worth, and after that it's whatever you've earned up and above that.
But on whole dollars, it doesn't make a difference. If you earned it before, then you'll pay the 20% later.
You're just
deferring. It's the same dollars, no?
No.
Okay, well, so we'll have the debate between the accountants and finance people later. But perhaps the reason why the Gemara didn't even think that was untenable is because what are we basing all of this off of? We're basing it off of agriculture stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So Professor Arbach...
There is no carry.
Right. So Professor Arbach notes that we see this expansion, and again, it's pretty obvious that we see this expansion from agriculture gifts to just regular business money gifts.
Yeah, but most people...
Specifically, around the time when Jews stopped owning land. Specifically around the time, he tracks different Mamari Chazal, but basically all of these started occurring during the generations after Churban Bayis when Jews stopped being landowners.
And they became renters.
Or just doing other forms of business. Even though Mida Oraisa, you may not have to give a Chomesh or Meiser from other types of money other than agriculture stuff, but Chazal wanted to expand it either to keep the spirit of the law or because they said, quite frankly,
reasons.
Yeah, just for practically, meaning when the Jewish people, the Chassam Sofer also suggests this, Chassam Sofer says, like, at the time when the Jewish people had their own political rulership and Jews owned land, so even though not everybody became farmers, you know, Shevet Zvulun did commerce, the entire poor population during peaceful times and stable times could be sustained based off of the Truma, Meiser, and Meiserani of a civilization that was primarily agriculture-based, even though you had some people that weren't. Mm-hmm. Once Churban Bayis took place and people weren't allowed to own land anymore, so Truma and Meiser and Truma and Meiserani were not going to cut it, so Chazal expanded it. Mm-hmm. So, but if we're modeling it after agriculture, so there is no Keren, or there's virtually no Keren to speak of, it's just whatever profit you turn in. So even though you could have answered the question that it's a fifth of a fifth of a fifth, this is more true to the Takana.
Yeah, but also, even though, what is the Keren? Presumably it's the land itself and the value of the land.
So that's interesting. So this goes into a broader topic about land, or at least Jewish land in Eretz Yisrael, that Jewish land in Eretz Yisrael is only supposed to be sold for a certain amount of time. Like in the Choshen Mishpat, in my Dayanus classes now, we're learning Ona is said within the context of selling land, because we say there is no concept of overcharging for land. Exactly. Ein Ona L'Karkos, because land is only supposed to be sold for X amount of time until Yovel, when everything reverts back. So that's not carrot. So you're not really selling it. You're not selling the land. You're leasing how much I can yield from the land.
You can get. But what about the original owner?
I can't transfer. That's what I'm saying. I can't transfer that. That's not a commodity. Meaning...
Nobody said you have to transfer your Karen.
I can only give something.
You evaluate what the Karen is.
No, what I'm trying to say is I can't give away land.
I
physically can't. So it doesn't make sense to give stuck on something I can't give away.
Well, you can't get the value of the land.
In other words, the land. What?
I mean, tzedakah is not a property tax. I mean, tzedakah is not a property tax. It's that I got something, so I want to give part of it away.
But isn't that what they mean by Karen?
No.
What else do they mean by Karen?
Because we're not talking about agriculture here, we got to start somewhere. So the first time around, you give a net
actual number of coins that you have in hiding in your wallet.
That's what I would say. Yeah.
All
Okay, yeah, you don't have to. This is what I'm saying. You could disagree with me. I'm not quoting anybody.
I would think it's your net worth.
Okay.
Net worth with property value.
With property value, but with your house and your home and
but property
whatever
value,
else.
I think, is effectively zero, and the future value is zero. The future value comes to zero.
It's not.
Net worth current.
Come on, what happens if you have something decreasing value evaluation?
Yeah. Or something that increases in value.
It doesn't, though, because eventually it's zero.
Well, if you're talking about property, then it could be, let's say a car. Car depreciates.
A car depreciates, but your house, your land, things of that sort don't depreciate.
That's why you have limits.
Okay.
So we depend on the government.
That's exactly what we're trying to avoid.
Okay. So let's.
All of Hilfus and Zekin is based on land. Okay, you evaluate the property,
right,
and that's what you pay.
So you can pay it. Yeah. Okay. So again, we're talking.
That's a point.
No. Again, I'm not trying to dismiss it. I'm saying that you are correct. Now, we live in Chutz Laretz. You can sell land forever. like Eugene said, in the Gemara in Bava Kamma, there are halachos that govern how I'm supposed to pay in land. I have to pay the best quality of land.
Right.
But land is clearly worth something.
Right.
What my point is that once we see that Chazal created this institution of tzedakah and they're modeling it off of a biblical idea, so they're going to model it off to the biblical idea, not this practical reality that we find ourselves in Golus or something like that. That's what I'm trying to say. But again, let's keep going, just because I want to try to. I said we try to cover all the history today, and there's one more part about the history that I want to talk about. Rav Huna Amar, but before we do that, we have another shita. Rav Huna Amar lemitzvos ad shlish. This is a totally different number that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't bring down. It's not a fifth; it's a third. So now the Gemara asks a question: Mahu lechol hamitzvos ad shlish? So is it that for all mitzvos you have to give a third? Le mitzvah achas, or is it even just for one mitzvah? Meaning, do I have to sort of like allocate my, you know, I group all my mitzvah, my annual mitzvahs into one category, or is it even whatever mitzvah comes my way?
So the Gemara in Baba Kamma applies this concept to Hiddur Mitzvah.
Yes, so this Gemara is going to get to Hiddur Mitzvah also, and another time we'll have to compare it to what the Bavli says about Hiddur Mitzvah. No, it might not be a machlokas at all. We'll see. But that's not for this week. I just want to go through the Gemara right now. But you are 100% correct.
Yeah, you got to come back next week.
Well, next week is okay also.
So
next week's there.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You're going to bring one of the kids with you.
You'll have to talk.
If I get to choose which.
You're running the kids with him. It's for kids. You're not to have the kids.
I didn't know how much fun I would get.
So, Savrinan, we thought, Meimar lechol ha-mitzvos ad shlish. So I might think that it's up to all my mitzvos. Rabbi Avon Amar filu mitzvah achas. No, even for one mitzvah. So Rabbi Chaviva b'shem Rabbanan d'taman. So Rabbi Chaviva said in the names of the rabbis from over there, which is Bavel, meaning this is Talmud Yerushalmi. So the rabbis over there said, Mahu shlish l'damim. What does it mean that it's a third? Hey Chavdinan, how do you calculate that? Lokach adam mitzvah v'ra acheres noa heimenu. If you purchased something for a mitzvah and then you saw something nicer, ad kama matrichin alav, how much do we impose on you to basically get rid of that one and buy this to upgrade? A third. This is a machlokas. What does that mean? Do I have to spend a third of everything, of all my assets, or is it an inflated price of what I paid up to a third? Meaning if I paid $100 for an esrog and then I see, ooh, there's an even nicer one, and I got a handle in the Arba Minim shook with the guy, so I can only do up to 130, up to 133 rather, something like that. So that's the question. And we say, there's a machlokas. It's a machlokas of Rishonim, how to explain that. Okay. Now, we talk about Hiddur Mitzvah, just as a tangent. Tane Rebbe Yishmael, ze keli van vehu, v'chi efshar lo la'adam l'navo sesboro. How can a person beautify Hashem? Ella an ve'alo b'mitzvos. I'll beautify him by doing mitzvos. Es elefan of lulav na, sukkah na, shofar na, tzitzis na, tefillin na. So all these objects will get beautiful ones. So what does that sound like? That sounds like that by having beautiful objects to serve God, I'm beautifying God. Abashal, though, has a different word. Adam Elo. It doesn't mean that I will beautify him by doing nice things for God. It's that I will beautify myself by comparing myself to God, and by doing that, I'll beautify God. Mahu chanan verachum, aftehei chanan verachum. Just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu exhibits certain midos, so too I also exhibit certain midos. So which drasha do we paskin like? Do we choose to spend money or to refine our character? It's an interesting question. But now we get back to Takana Susha. And this is the part that I want to talk about. Maisa b'Rebbe Yeshevav. So Rebbe Yeshevav got up. She'omad v'chilek es kol nechasav la'aniyim. So this is that story that we saw in the Bavli of Rebbe Yeshevav. He gave away everything. And so once again, this is the point that the academics in the Shagasari and all the Mefarshim point out. That even though they pasken this shaila, clearly this was a point of contention for many, many generations. People vehemently disagreed. Rabbanim vehemently disagreed. Shalach lo Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel sent to him, V'alo amru chamesh minachasav lemitzvos. We set up to a fifth, you can't do this. So, first of all, this seems to say that we pasken like a fifth and not a third, and that's why many of you have never heard of the third thing. When it comes to a limit of regular expenditure on mitzvahs.
Have a problem with it.
Yeah?
Rav Huna was set up to a third. Rav Huna was in Bavel.
Yeah.
The Yerushalmi was in...
Yeah, so like I said, this was not a unanimous thing. There may have been different communities, different rabbanim that really disagreed with this takana.
But they also traveled back.
But they did travel back and forth, yes. So Rabban Gamliel sent to him, no, you can't do this. But then the Gemara asks, for Rabban Gamliel, lo kodem l'ushahaya. Look at the sheet. So Rabban Gamliel lived, he died in the year 118. The Sanhedrin only moved to Usha. We don't know exactly when it moved, but it was only after Hadrian died, more than 20 years later, after Rabban Gamliel died. So what does the Gemara answer?
Was there only one Rabban Gamliel?
At that time, yeah. At that time, yes. There were later ones, but at this time, yes. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Bon b'Shem Reb Levi, kach hoysa halacha b'yadam u'shechachuha. They had this halacha and they forgot.
What?
V'omdu hashniyim, and the later generation came up with it again, apparently.
Are you referring to the
Zugos? So we'll see what that means. V'hiskimu aldas harishonim, and somehow ended up with the same idea like the first generation did. L'lamedcha, and this teaches you, shekol davar shebeistin nosnin nafshan alav. Anything that a beistin is moser nefesh, or really applies themselves to, sof hu miskayim, will ultimately be established. Just like happened by Moshe at Sinai. This is a very, very weird
Gemara. I love it. It shows that there's so much logic in that everything that's done that you'll come up to, you put your mind to it, you'll come up to the same conclusion.
Yeah, so that's probably the simplest way to understand what the Yerushalmi is saying, is that if you really work hard enough, you'll figure it out because it's MS, because it's the truth. I had a Rebbe in 10th grade. He was like a little Hasidish. So he said he loved discovering, if your grandson remembers, Rabbi Gluck. He was a pseudo Hasidish person. So he said that the biggest simcha that he would get was when he would find a Litvish sefer and a Hasidish sefer would say the same vart, because it means that it's MS, when you can have two completely different ways of thinking. And if you say the same thing, so it means that there's some MS here. So that's probably the simplest way. And there's a story about Moshe Rabbeinu in Menachos. That Moshe Rabbeinu, this is a question which, to some students may seem heretical, but did Moshe know everything at Har Sinai that later generations did? Right. So
someone was listening.
Yeah. And so the answer is, at least according to the Rambam, no. Mm-hmm. And there's the Gemara in Menachos pretty much says it explicitly, that Moshe Rabbeinu came and saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu making tagin, making crowns on the letters. And he said, who's that for?
Yeah, what's that?
Clearly Moshe didn't know. And he said, oh, it's for Rabbi Akiva.
So he said,
So let me see. He doesn't understand what's going on. And then Rabbi Akiva says, oh, halacha Moshe Misinai. So Moshe felt better. How does that make Moshe feel better if he didn't understand the first 45 minutes of the shiur? What it means is that ultimately it's emes, because you can trace back the genesis of this idea to Moshe, even though all these developments emerged later. So that also might be what this Yerushalmi is talking about.
Halacha Moshe Misinai is the reverse. It's like you can't understand it, but it happens.
Right. So halacha Moshe Misinai means the flip side, that there's a kernel, meaning that there's some halacha that I wouldn't know without Moshe, and then we can take that and then we can work with it within the confines of the halachic system to expand. The Gra has a very different girsa of this Gemara for technical reasons. He actually changes the words around. If you're in the Art Scroll and you turn the page to the nice thing about the Art Scroll Yerushalmis is that they talk about other girsos, other textual versions. So if you look at the textual and interpretive variants under A. So he says, admittedly, however, the expression Kemoshe Nemar Lemoshe Misinai is a bit troubling according to either one of the explanations, what they are not for now. Gra, in his commentary to the Mishnah, however, explains that when the Gemara says Kach Haisa Halacha Biyadam, that they had a tradition, it means that the prohibition against giving more than a fifth originated as a Halacha Lemoshe Misinai. Meaning this limit is a Halacha De'oraisa. Forgotten over the generations, the Sinaitic law was reinstated by the Sanhedrin in Usha. And that's what our Gemara means. Nobody else agrees with the Vilna Gaon, because the Vilna Gaon A has to change a little bit of the words. And also, like, again, that's not what our Gemara seems to say. And you have people that are arguing. So you have, the Rambam says that halacha Moshe Misinai, there's no room for argument. Yeah. So they forgot this halacha Moshe Misinai and somehow, and then somehow they managed to stumble on it again. And so it's a d'oraisa, and these people are still disagreeing with it. What does that mean? That they're saying it's not a halacha Moshe Misinai?
That's what they're saying.
So,
there are many instances in the Gemara where somebody didn't have a Kabbalah that say halacha Moshe Misinai. So they argued.
That there's an example of somebody that has a Kabbalah that it wasn't a halacha Moshe Misinai?
They don't have the Kabbalah, so therefore they don't hold with the person who says this halacha Moshe
Misinai. I guess that could be, but we generally really don't like to think that all of Klal Yisrael forgot halacha Moshe Misinai. I mean, we have that story with Osniel ben Knaz, but like that how he they forgot thousands of halachos and then he reinstated them with his own logic. But we really don't like to say that throughout history. But again, I'm not saying it's impossible, but we really don't like to say it. The Vilna Gaon was motivated to by various reasons. Most, though, Achronim disagree, because again, otherwise you get into Stukas d'oraisa, which really doesn't. I mean, most of us paskin nowadays that the limits in place of Meiser and a fifth are minhagim or rabbanon, the rabbanons at best. But the Vilna Gaon disagrees, just to put that on the record. The other point, though, is that Rabban Gamliel was before Usha. So if you look at the timeline again, so I have over here two question mark dates towards the end. So there's the Rimon Valley meeting near Tzipori. That is a Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which describes how a group of Chachamim, not the Nasi, not Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, because he was still hiding, gathered together near Tzipori. If you look on the map, it's like parallel to Tveria in the middle of the country. So we don't know exactly where the Rimon Valley is, but it's a little bit north of there. And that was near where Usha was. The city of Usha was sympathetic to the Romans, and the rabbis there were loyal to the Romans, so they felt on more politically stable ground. And then a little bit later, when they achieved a little bit of more safety, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel comes to Usha and makes these takanos. So Rabban Gamliel clearly was long dead. However, look at the Bavli that I have on the beginning of the page. So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says, Ukenegdan Golsa Sanhedrin, that the Sanhedrin was exiled 10 times. Mi Gemara, we have a tradition. Milishkas hagazis lechanus. They went outside of the temple courtyard, the temple room of the Lishkas hagazis, to like the open storefront areas by the Beis Hamikdash. Umechanus liYerushalayim, to the Yerushalayim. UmiYerushalayim liYavne. UmiYavne leUsha. UmiYusha liYavne. UmiYavne leUsha. So it went back and forth. It bounced back and forth between them. And if you look at Rashi, Rashi says, Kishahaya Hanasi Darbo, when the Nasi would live there, that's where the Sanhedrin was. So that, because the Sanhedrin orbited around the Nasi. And then when he moved, it went with them. So according to this, the Nasi bounced back and forth to different places in Usha, to different places. He went from what's it called? From Yavne to Usha and then back to Yavne. So why would that be? And also, we don't seem to have record of that. So some people say the Gemara made a mistake. Some academics say the Gemara is wrong. There are some from scholars that have a different opinion, which is, as I said, look at the dates. So Rabbi Gamliel died in 118. Hadrian only became emperor after that. Hadrian only became emperor the year before. So who was, though, before that? There was Trajan. Trajan did not like the Jews. Before that, though, was Nerva. Nerva only lived for 2 years, but he had a relatively tolerant attitude towards the Jews and repealed some of the decrees that were after the Flavian dynasty of Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. They were father's son. They were not good to the Jews. Domitian was very autocratic in general and really had a lot of decrees against the Jews. Nerva came and repealed many of them. Then Hadrian came and just reinstated it. So it was and Trajan also. It was a very short time period, though, of relative peace. So what some people say is that they were in Yavne, then they went up north to Usha during that period of relative safety to kind of shore up some political power in the north. And then after Nerva died and Trajan came, they said, okay, we got to regroup. They went back to Yavne. So that's what some people suggest, that move to Usha actually happened. It was just so short. It was a blip. So we have an oral tradition that it happened, but it wasn't so long. Nothing much happened to speak of. But that could be. So yes, Rabbi Gamliel may have come before the Takanas of Usha. That was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, his son. But there could have already been a Rabbi Gamliel in the Usha area, honestly. And it could be that that's where these discussions were still taking place. All of these discussions may have been taking place in the north, and it just weren't formalized until Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. But it could be that Rabbi Gamliel himself was genuinely talking about these things, even in Usha. And so when we talk about Takanas Usha, yes, it was only formalized later, but even the groundwork may have been laid in Usha decades and decades beforehand. That's where I want to leave you today. Next week in Mirtz Hashem, what I hope to talk to you about is the Shita of the Rambam. So as I said, the Rambam in the Yad HaChazakah is the language that the Shulchan Aruch gets. So the Shulchan Aruch seems to say that it's a good idea to spend more. It's a mitzvah min hamuvchar to spend more. But the Rambam in another place says that you shouldn't fritter away money on mitzvos based on paskening the Gemara and Erchin. And then in his commentary to Mishnah, which he wrote earlier on Peah, he seems to side even more like the Yerushalmi and less like the Bavli. So what I hope to talk, and the Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer on Tzedakah deals with this a lot, and he says that there's actually two different types of scenarios of Tzedakah. One, where someone confronts you, and the other is just when you're allocating, all right, I have this much money I can give. And the Chafetz Chaim says that the Bavli and the Yerushalmi are not arguing at all. They're actually talking about two separate cases. One is when somebody sticks out their hand. That's what the Bavli's talking about. And the Yerushalmi is just hamafresh minachasav. You're separating. You're planning out. You're mapping out your year. That's when there's no sense of urgency. So Mitzvah Hashem, we'll talk about that next week. All right. Take care. Yeah.